Code 3 by Rick Raphael. Part 2. The motor pool exit opened into a quarter-mile-wide tunnel, sloping gently down into the bowels of the great city. Car 56 glided down the slight incline at a steady 50 miles an hour. A mile from the mouth of the tunnel, the roadway leveled off, and Ben kicked Beulah up another 25 miles an hour. Ahead, the main tunnel ended in a series of smaller portal ways, each emblazoned with a huge illuminated number designating a continental throughway. Ben throttled back and began edging to the left lanes. Other patrol cars were heading down the main passageway, bound for their assigned throughways. As Ben eased down to a slow 30, another patrol vehicle slid alongside. The two troopers in the cab waved. Clay flicked on the car-to-car transmit. The senior trooper in car 104 looked over at Martin and Ferguson.
"If it isn't the gruesome twosome," he called. "Where have you two been? We thought the front office had finally caught up with you and found out that neither one of you could read or write, and that they had canned you."
"We can't read," Ben quipped back. "That's why we're still on the job. The front office would never hire anyone who would embarrass you two by being smarter than either of you. Where are you headed, Eddie?"
"Got 154 north," the other officer said.
"Hey," Clay called out. "I got a real hot doll in Tirana, and I'll gladly sell her phone number for a proper price."
"Wouldn't want her to hurt you, Clay," the other officer replied. "If I called her up and took her out, she'd throw rocks at you the next time you drew the run. It's all for your own good."
"Go get lost in a clover leaf," Clay retorted.
The other car broke the connection and, with a wave, veered off to the right. The throughway entrances were just ahead. Martin aimed Beulah at the lighted orifice topped with the number 26W. The patrol car slid into the narrower tunnel, glided along for another mile, and then turned its bow upward. 3 minutes later, they emerged from the tunnel into the red patrol lane of Continental Thruway 26 West. The late afternoon sky was a covering of gray wool, and a drop or two of moisture struck the front face of the cab canopy. For a mile on either side of the police lane, streams of cars sped westward. Ben eyed the sky, the traffic, and then peered at the outer hull thermometer. It read 32 degrees. He made a mental bet with himself that the Weather Bureau was off on its snow estimates by 6 hours. His Vermont upbringing told him it would be flurrying within an hour. He increased speed to a steady 100, and the car sped silently and easily along the police lane. Across the cab, Clay peered pensively at the steady stream of cars and cargo carriers racing by in the green and blue lanes, all of them moving faster than the patrol car. The young officer turned in his seat and looked at his partner.
"You know, Ben," he said gravely, "I sometimes wonder if those old-time cowboys got as tired looking at the south end of northbound cows as I get looking at the vanishing tailpipes of cars."
The radio came to life.
"Billy Control to Car 56.
Clay touched his transmit place.
"This is 5-6. Go ahead.
"You've got a bad one at marker 82,
Control said.
"A sideswipe in the white."
"Couldn't be too bad in the white,"
Ben broke in, thinking of the 100-mile-an-hour limit in the slow lane.
"That's not the problem,"
Control came back.
"One of the sideswiped vehicles was flipped around and bounded into the green, and that's where the real mess is. Make it code 3.
5-6, acknowledge, Ben said. On the way. He slammed forward on the throttles. The bullhorn blared, and a second later, with MSO Kelly Lightfoot snugged in her dispensary cocoon, and both troopers in body cushions, Car 56 lifted a foot from the roadway and leapt forward on a turbulent pad of air. It accelerated from 100 to 250 miles an hour. The great red emergency lights on the bow and stern began to blink, and from the special transmitter in the hull, a radio siren wail raced ahead of the car to be picked up by the emergency receptor antennas required on all vehicles. The working part of the patrol had begun. Conversation died in the speeding car, partly because of the concentration required by the troopers, secondly because all transmissions, whether intercom or radio, on a code 2 or 3 run, were taped and monitored by control. In the center of the instrument panel, an oversized radiodometer was clicking off the mileage marks as the car passed each milestone. The milestone posts beamed a coded signal across all 5 lanes, and as each vehicle passed the marker, the radiodometer clicked up another number. Car 56 had been at MM23 when the call came. Now, at better than 4 miles a minute, Beulah whipped past MM45 with 10 minutes yet to go to reach the scene of the accident. Light flurries of wet snow bounced off the canopy, leaving thin, fast-drying trails of moisture. Although it was still a few minutes short of 1700 hours, the last of the winter afternoon light was being lost behind the heavy snow clouds ahead. Ben turned on the patrol car's dazzling headlight, and to the left and right, Clay could see streaks of white lights from the traffic on the green and blue lanes on either side of the quarter-mile-wide emergency lane. The radio filled them in on the movement of other patrol emergency vehicles being routed to the accident site. Car 82, also assigned to Nat 26 West, was more than 150 miles ahead of Beulah. Pittsburgh Control ordered 8-2 to hold fast to cover anything else that might come up while 5-6 was handling the current crisis. Eastbound car 119 was ordered to cut across to the scene to assist Beulah's crew, and another eastbound patrol vehicle was held in place to cover for 119. At mile marker 80, yellow caution lights were flashing on all westbound lanes, triggered by Philadelphia Control the instant the word of the crash had been received. Traffic was slowing down and piling up, despite the half-mile-wide lanes.
Philly Control, this is car 5-6.
Go ahead, 5-6.
It's piling up in the green and white, Ben said. Let's divert to blue on slowdown and seal the yellow.
Philly Control acknowledged,
came the reply. The flashing amber caution lights on all lanes switched to red. As Ben began deacceleration, diagonal red flashing barriers rose out of the roadway on the green and white lanes at the 85-mile marker and lane crossing. This channeled all traffic from both lanes to the left and into the blue lane, where the flashing reds now prohibited speeds in excess of 50 miles an hour around the emergency situation. At the same time, all crossovers on the ultra-high yellow lane were sealed by barriers to prevent changing of lanes into the over-congested area. As car 5-6's speed dropped back below the 200-mile-an-hour mark, the cocoon automatically slid open. Freed from her safety restraints, Kelly jumped for the rear entrance of the dispensary and cleared the racking clamps from the 6 auto litters. That done, she opened another locker and reached for the mobile first aid kit. She slid it to the door entrance on its retractable casters. She slipped on her work helmet with the built-in transmitter and then sat down on the seat by the rear door to wait until the car stopped. Car 5-6 was now less than 2 miles from the scene of the crash, and traffic in the green lane to the left was at a standstill. A half mile farther westward, lights were still moving slowly along the white lane. Ahead, the troopers could see a faint wisp of smoke rising from the heaviest congregation of headlights. Both officers had their work helmets on, and Clay had left his seat and descended to the side door, ready to jump out the minute the car stopped. Martin saw a clear area in the green lane and swung the car over the dividing curbing. The big tracks floated the patrol car over the 2-foot-high rounded abutment that divided each speed lane. Snow was falling faster as the headlight picked out a tangled mass of wreckage smoldering 100 feet inside the median separating the green and white lanes. A crumpled body lay on the pavement 20 feet from the biggest clump of smashed metal, and other fragments of vehicles were strung out down the roadway for 50 feet. There was no movement. Norcon throughway laws were strict, and none were more rigidly enforced than the regulation that no one other than a member of the patrol set foot outside of their vehicle while on any throughway traffic lane. This meant not giving any assistance whatsoever to accident victims. The ruling had been called inhuman, monstrous, unthinkable, and lawmakers in the 3 nations of the compact had forced Norcon to revoke the rule in the early days of the throughways. After speeding cars and cargo carriers had cut down twice as many do-gooders on foot at accident scenes than the accidents themselves caused, the law was reinstated. The lives of the many were more vital than the lives of a few. Martin halted the patrol vehicle a few feet from the wreckage, and Beulah was still rocking gently on her tracks by the time both Patrol Trooper Clay Ferguson and MSO Kelly Lightfoot hit the pavement on the run. In the cab, Martin called in on the radio. Car 56 is on scene. Release blue at marker 95, and resume speed all lanes at marker 95 in... He paused and looked back at the halted traffic piled up before the lane had been closed. 7 minutes. He jumped for the steps and sprinted out of the patrol car in the wake of Ferguson and Kelly. The team's surgeon was kneeling beside the inert body on the road. After an ear to the chest, Kelly opened her field kit bag and slapped an electrode to the victim's temple. The needle on the encephalic meter in the lid of the kit never flickered. Kelly shut the bag and hurried with it over to the mass of wreckage. A thin column of black oily smoke rose from somewhere near the bottom of the heap. It was almost impossible to identify at a glance whether the mangled metal was the remains of one or more cars. Only the absence of track equipment made it certain that they even had been passenger vehicles. Clay was carefully climbing up the side of the piled-up wrecks to a window that gaped near the top. "Work fast, kid," Martin called up. "Something's burning down there, and this whole thing may go up. I'll get this traffic moving." He turned to face the halted mass of cars and cargo carriers east of the wreck. He flipped the switch that cut his helmet transmitter into the remote standard vehicular radio circuit aboard the patrol car. "Attention, please, all cars in green lane. All cars in the left line move out now. The next line fall in behind. You are directed to clear the area immediately. Maintain 50 miles an hour for the next mile. You may resume desired speeds and change lanes at mile marker 95. I repeat, all cars in green lane." He went over the instructions once more, relayed through Beulah's transmitter to the standard receivers on all cars. He was still talking as the traffic began to move. By the time he turned back to help his teammates, cars were moving in a steady stream past the huge red flashing bulk of the patrol car. Both Clay and Kelly were lying flat across the smashed, upturned side of the uppermost car in the pile. Kelly had her field bag open on the ground, and she was reaching down through the smashed window.
"What is it, Clay?"
Martinet called. The younger officer looked down over his shoulder.
"We've got a woman alive down here, but she's wedged in tight. She's hurt pretty badly, and Kelly's trying to slip a hypo into her now. Get the arm out, Ben."
Martin ran back to the patrol car and flipped up a panel on the hall. He pulled back on one of the several levers recessed into the hall, and the big wrecking crane swung smoothly out of its cradle and over the wreckage. The end of the crane arm was directly over Ferguson.
"Let me have the spreaders," Clay called.
The arm dipped, and from either side of the tip, a pair of flanges shot out like tusks on an elephant.
"Put her in neutral," Clay directed.
Martin pressed another lever, and the crane now could be moved in any direction by fingertip pulls at its extremity. Ferguson carefully guided the crane with its projecting tusks into the smashed orifice of the car window.
"Okay, Ben, spread it."
The crane locked into position, and the entire arm split open in a V from its base. Martin pressed steadily on the two levers controlling each side of the divided arm, and the tusks dug into the sides of the smashed window. There was a steady screeching of tearing and ripping metal as the crane tore window and frame apart.
"Hold it!"
Ferguson yelled, and then eased himself into the widened hole.
"Ben!"
Kelly called from her perch atop the wreckage.
"Litter!"
Martin raced to the rear of the patrol car where the sloping ramp stood open to the lighted dispensary. He snatched at one of the auto litters and triggered its tiny drive motor. A homing beacon in his helmet guided the litter as it rolled down the ramp, turned by itself, and rolled across the pavement a foot behind him. It stopped when he stopped, and Ben touched another switch, cutting the homing beacon. Clay's head appeared out of the hole.
"Get it up here, Ben. I can get her out. And I think there's another one alive, still further down."
Martin raised the crane, and its ripper bars retracted. The split arm spewed a pair of cables terminating in magna locks. The cables dangled over the ends of the auto litter, caught the lift plates on the litter, and a second later the cart was swinging beside the smashed window as Clay and Kelly eased the torn body of a woman out of the wreckage and onto the litter. As Ben brought the litter back to the pavement, the column of smoke had thickened. He disconnected the cables and homed the stretcher back to the patrol car. The hospital cart with its unconscious victim rolled smoothly back to the car, up the ramp, and into the dispensary to the surgical table. Martin climbed up the wreckage beside Kelly. Inside the twisted interior of the car, the thick smoke all but obscured the bent back of the younger trooper, and his powerful hand light barely penetrated the gloom. Blood was smeared over almost every surface, and the stink of leaking jet fuel was virtually overpowering. From the depths of the nightmarish scene came a tortured scream. Kelly reached into a coverall pocket and produced another sedation hypo. She squirmed around and started to slip down into the wreckage with Ferguson. Martin grabbed her arm.
"No, Kelly, this thing's ready to blow. Come on, Clay, get out of there, now!"
Ferguson continued to pry at the twisted plates below him.
"I said get out of there, Ferguson," the senior officer roared. "And that's an order!"
Clay straightened up and put his hands on the edge of the window to boost himself out.
"Ben, there's a guy alive down there. We can't just leave him." "Get down from there, Kelly," Martin ordered. "I know that man's down there just as well as you do, Clay.
but we won't be helping him one damn bit if we get blown to hell and gone, right along with him. Now get out of there, and maybe we can pull this thing apart and get to him before it does blow."
The lanky Canadian eased out of the window, and the two troopers moved back to the patrol car. Kelly was already in her dispensary working on the injured woman. Martin slid into his control seat.
"Shut your ramp, Kelly," he called over the intercom. "I'm going to move around to the other side."
The radio broke in.
"Car 119 to car 56. We're just turning into the divider. Be there in a minute."
"Snap it up," Ben replied. "We need you in a hurry."
As he maneuvered Beulah around the wreckage, he snapped orders to Ferguson.
"Get the foam nozzles up, just in case, and then stand by on the crane."
A mile away, they saw the flashing emergency lights of car 119 as it raced diagonally across the yellow and blue lanes, whipping with ponderous ease through the moving traffic.
"Take the south side, 119, Martin called out. "We'll try to pull this mess apart."
"Affirmative," came the reply.
Even before the other patrol vehicle came to a halt, its crane was swinging out from the side, and the ganged Magnalocks were dangling from their cables.
"Okay, kid," Ben ordered. "Hook it."
At the interior crane controls, Clay swung Beulah's crane and cable mags toward the wreckage. The Magnalock slammed into the metallic mess with a bang. Almost at the same instant, the locks hit the other side from car 119. Clay eased up the cable slack.
"Good!" Ben called to both Clay and the operating trooper in the other car. "Now let's pull it!"
"Look out! Foam! Foam! Foam!" he yelled.
The ugly deep red fireball from the exploding wreckage was still growing as Clay slammed down on the fire control panel. A curtain of thick chemical foam burst from the poised nozzles atop Beulah's hull, and a split second later, another stream of foam erupted from the other patrol car. The dense oxygen-absorbing retardant blanket snuffed the fire out in 3 seconds. The cranes were still secured to the foam-covered heap of metal.
"Never mind the caution," Ben called out. "Get it apart. Fast!"
Both crane operators slammed their controls into reverse, and with an ear-splitting screech, the twisted frames of the two vehicles ripped apart into tumbled heaps of broken metal and plastics. Martin and Ferguson jumped down the hatch steps and into ankle-deep foam and oil. They waded and slipped around the front of the car to join the troopers from the other car. Ferguson was pawing at the scum-covered foam near the mangled section of one of the cars.
"He should be right about..."
Clay paused and bent over.
"Here."
He straightened up as the others gathered around the scorched and ripped body of a man, half submerged in the thick foam.
"Kelly," he called over the helmet transmitter, "open your door. We'll need a couple of sacks."
He trudged to the rear of the patrol car, and met the girl standing in the door with a pair of folded plastic morgue bags in her hands. Behind her, Clay could see the body of the woman on the surgical table, an array of tubes and probes leading to plasma drip bottles and other equipment racked out over the table.
"How is she?"
"Not good," Kelly replied. "Skull fracture, ruptured spleen, broken ribs and double leg fractures. I've already called for an ambulance." Ferguson nodded, took the bags from her, and waded back through the foam. The four troopers worked in the silence of the deserted traffic lane. 100 yards away, traffic was moving steadily in the slow white lane. 3/4 of a mile to the south, fast and ultra-high traffic sped at its normal pace in the blue and yellow lanes. Westbound green was still being rerouted into the slower white lane around the scene of the accident. It was now 26 minutes since Car 5-6 had received the accident call. The light snow flurries had turned to a steady fall of thick, wet flakes, melting as they hit on the warm pavement, but beginning to coat the pitiful flotsam of the accident. The troopers finished the gruesome task of getting the bodies into the morgue sacks and laid beside the dispensary ramp for the ambulance to pick up with the surviving victim. Car 119's MSO had joined Kelly in Beulah's dispensary to give what help she might. The four patrol troopers began the grim task of probing the scattered wreckage for other possible victims, personal possessions, and identification. They were stacking a small pile of hand luggage when the long, low bulk of the ambulance swung out of the police lane and rolled to a stop. Longer than the patrol cars, but without the non-medical emergency facilities, the ambulance was in reality a mobile hospital. A full, scrubbed-up surgical team was waiting in the main operating room, even as the ramps opened and the techs headed for Car 5-6. The team had been briefed by radio on the condition of the patient, had read the full recordings of the diagnostician, and were watching transmitted pulse and respiration graphs on their own screens while the transfer was being made. The two women MSOs had unlocked the surgical table in Beulah's dispensary, and a plastic tent covered not only the table and the patient, but also the plasma and regen racks overhead. The entire table and rig slid down the ramp onto a motor-driven dolly from the ambulance. Without delay, it wheeled across the open few feet of pavement into the ambulance and to the surgery room. The techs locked the table into place in the other vehicle and left the surgery. From a storage compartment, they wheeled out a fresh patrol dispensary table and rack and placed it in Kelly's miniature surgery. The dead went into the morgue aboard the ambulance. The ramp closed, and the ambulance swung around and headed across the traffic lanes to eastbound Nat 26 and Philadelphia. Outside, the four troopers had completed the task of collecting what little information they could from the smashed vehicles. They returned to their cars, and 119's medical surgical officer headed back to her own cubbyhole. The other patrol car swung into position, almost touching Beulah's left flank. With Ben at the control seat, on command, both cars extended broad bulldozer blades from their bows.
"Let's go," Ben ordered.
The two patrol vehicles moved slowly down the roadway, pushing all the scattered scraps and parts onto a single great heap. They backed off, shifted direction toward the center police lane, and began shoving the debris, foam, and snow out of the green lane. At the edge of the police lane, both cars unshipped cranes and magna-lifted the junk over the divider barrier onto the 100-foot-wide service strip bordering the police lane. A slow cargo wrecker was already on the way from Pittsburgh Barracks to pick up the wreckage and haul it away. When the last of the metallic debris had been deposited off the traffic lane, Martin called control.
Car 5-6 is clear. Nat 26 West Green is clear.
Philly Control acknowledged. 7 miles to the east, the amber warning lights went dark, and the detour barrier at crossover 85 sank back into the roadway. 3 minutes later, traffic was again flashing by on Green Lane, past the two halted patrol cars.
"Pit control, this is car 119, clear of accident," the other car reported. "Car 119, resume eastbound patrol," came the reply.
The other patrol car pulled away. The two troopers waved at Martin and Ferguson in Beulah.
"See you later, and thanks,"
Ben called out.
He switched to intercom. Kelly, any ID on that woman?
Not a thing, Ben, she replied. About 40 years old, and she had a wedding band. She never was conscious, so I can't help you.
Ben nodded and looked over at his partner.
Go get into some dry clothes, kid, he said, while I finish the report. Then you can take it for a while.
Clay nodded and headed back to the crew quarters. End of Part 2.